the theme of David's life as we've been studying it these past few weeks and months together, which of course is that it is not perfection but devotion that warms the heart of God. And David's life has certainly offered us a beautiful illustration of that. Now, I wonder if you have wondered, as I have, as we have gotten to know David, just what God's reception of David must have been like when David stepped into glory. David's was a very checkered past, and his performance as a man after God's heart certainly left enormous gaps, just as our own lives themselves leave. Well, you'll be interested to know that I have been able, through some diligent scholarship and research, to discover David's epitaph. And as far as I know, this will be the first public reading, and we will wait until the end to take a look at David's own handwritten epitaph, which will summarize his reception by the Lord in heaven. But first, it's fitting that David's life should be come to a conclusion in the scripture with his last words to his son Solomon. There are famous last words throughout history and literature, of course. You movie buffs will recall the last word of Orson Welles' character Citizen Kane in the movie by that same name. You remember what it was? Rosebud. That's right, the name of his little sled. And then there's several famous last words attributed to Stonewall Jackson. The one I like the best on his deathbed was, "Over the river and into the trees." W.C. Fields, that famous comedian and self-proclaimed atheist, of course, was sitting on his deathbed thumbing through the Bible, and someone who knew him well asked him why he had suddenly taken up religion. He said he hadn't taken up religion, he was just looking for loopholes. And we're reminded, too, that Irma Brombeck said that she wanted on her tombstone, "I told you I was sick." And so I was looking this week at Hamlet, where the famous last words of Polonius, you remember Polonius, the counselor to his son Laertes, and he began by saying, "Now you're taking a trip, Laertes, and these few precepts in thy memory." And then he goes on with a few precepts that run five or six pages, and ends up with, "To thy own self be true, it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man." Well, last words of fathers to sons are famous for two reasons. First of all, because no father can resist giving good advice to his son. And second, because no son can resist ignoring the advice completely. And that has been true throughout all of history. Fatherly advice is the only product in world history for which no known market exists, but which continues to be produced in limitless quantities. And as a father, I can testify to the truth of that. Now, the reason for that is because both father and son are ruled by a great principle. And that great principle was first articulated by that eminent theologian and second story man, Murph the Serf, when he said, "You can't tell nobody nothing." And if you were to study the life of Solomon, you would see the extent to which that is true. David would certainly have agreed with whoever reported on the fifth grader who was asked who Socrates was, and he replied, "Socrates was an old Greek who gave people such good advice that they poisoned him." And David couldn't resist the temptation to give his son some good advice. And as we listen to these final words of David, as David tells Solomon some things that he needs to hear, he will doubtless tell us a few things that we need to hear also. And as we get into that, let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, this morning we thank you for the privilege of coming together in your house to worship in your name. It's a joy to be Christians, Father, and we claim the promise that you've sent your Holy Spirit, and your Spirit will teach us this morning. And we thank you for that. In Jesus' precious name, amen. Let's look at the background of Solomon's inheritance. Now, these last words of David were spoken just before Solomon was inaugurated as king. He was actually tapped by David to be king because there was considerable jockeying for position and the possibility that Solomon might not even be able to take the throne. So David preempted a coup d'etat by having Solomon touched as king before he died. Now, David had taken Israel, as we have seen, from a loose federation of tribes, forged it into a nation, and from that nation had actually created a dynamic, thriving, and balanced empire. They moved from constant warfare to a condition of relative peace. David had built, as we've seen, an army that exceeded 1 million fighting men, probably the most dynamic fighting machine of that particular time, which was, as we've also seen, roughly 1000 B.C. He had established a royal capital, had moved the ark to that capital so that the capital became not only the political center of influence in the region, but also the economic center, as well as the place from which all of the kingly proclamations emanated, and also, most importantly, because this was a kingly kingdom, but still with the girdings and undergirdings of a theocracy, it became the center of the people's spiritual life. Jerusalem did, and of course, that has obtained down to the present day. David left, as a great legacy, a prosperous nation and one that feared God. And as we will see as we begin to get into our next Old Testament studies together, particularly the life of Elijah, all of this comes to pieces after Solomon's reign concludes and civil war breaks out. But at the time that David handed the kingdom over to Solomon, the kingdom was in better shape than it had ever been in before and ever would be again until the coming of Messiah. Now, how had a former shepherd boy pulled all of that off? What would he say to his son after a 40-year tumultuous reign, one of the most dynamic figures in all of history? Well, his final words are in the book of 1 Chronicles in the 28th chapter, and we'll look at those as we close. But first, I would like to imagine how David might have reviewed the lessons of his life for his son Solomon, because he knew that Solomon needed guidance. In 1 Chronicles 29, David has called all of the assembly together and is speaking to them perhaps for the last time, and he says this. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 1. David the king said to all the assembly, "Solomon my son, whom God alone has chosen, is young and inexperienced, and the work is great." David knew that Solomon needed guidance, and he, of course, as a good father, was certainly prepared to provide that. So I have wondered what it might have been like if David had written a letter to his son Solomon, sort of capsulizing and summing up the lessons that he had learned from his long, arduous, and very productive life. Perhaps David might have begun that letter one night late in his study. We might imagine that the fire is burned down, that he's put additional oil in the lamp, that he's sitting by the light of this one flickering lamp at his table, drawn up close to the fire. David is an old man by now, circulation not as good as it was. He's tucked his lap robe around him, and he's taken out his scroll and his pen, and he's begun to write a few things to his son and to his heir, Solomon. And he might have said something like, "Dear Solomon, tomorrow you are going to be tapped as king of Israel. Your inaugural is on the morrow. And I've got a few things that I'd like to pass along to you. It's late now. I'm not going to try to tell you everything. But the first thing I'd like to say to you is that I see some things in your life that bother me. Now, they bother me because they remind me of me. I see some things in you that remind me of me. You're proud, and you're self-indulgent, and you're wayward, as you would see from having studied the life of Solomon. That was certainly true. So let your old man pass on just a few things to you about what he's learned in his life. Now, my life, Solomon, my life could probably best be told in terms of the people whom God sent into my life to teach me. Now, I thought while it was happening to me that these were just faces along the way. But I've seen since then that they were instruments, tools that God used to mold me. So let me tell you a few things about what God has taught me through a few of the people who have passed through my life. The first name, Solomon, that I would have to offer up to you is, of course, the name of Saul, the great king who preceded me. And Saul was a great man. I know he's had a bad press in the last 40 years because he ended up as a man who lost everything that God gave him. But let me tell you, Solomon, Saul began as a great man and a great king. What happened to him was he began to drift away from God. As he drifted farther away from God and his pride and his ego took hold of him, he was set aside. So the first thing I want to say to you, Solomon, that I've learned from the life of Saul is that sin sets us aside. We become useless as servants. No matter how effective, no matter how dynamic, no matter how gifted we are, sin sets us aside. It also robs us of our power. Saul was a powerful man, the king of what could have been a mighty nation, but because of sin, he lost his power. And then remember from what you hear from me, Solomon, that sin is very subtle in its cruelty, because I watched over the years as Saul's entire personality was eroded by this terrible sin of pride. And finally, I saw him come to the place that he was mad and killed himself. Well, what I remember then in these closing hours and days of my life, Solomon, is from the life of Saul, is that sin robs us of our power as it sets us aside. You'll be interested to know, Solomon, that the next person that I really learned something vividly from was old Goliath. He said, you know, I was just a kid. I was a shepherd boy with a sling. Now, it's hard for you to believe, seeing this old creaky bag of bones that's sitting in front of this fireplace now, I know, but I was once the most vital, dynamic youngster in all of Israel. I'll never forget how the armies looked on that morning. It was a wide valley with a creek running down through the middle, and the armies of Israel, with Saul in command, were arrayed on one slope, and facing them on the other slope were the hosts of the Philistines. And down below, every morning and every evening, this giant of a man would come out, standing at the bottom, roaring defiance, taunting us, and cursing our God. 9 feet tall and at least half that wide, the most incredible vision of terror that you have ever seen. His armor glistening in the sun. Solomon, it was a sight I'll never forget. And you know, when he saw me, he was insulted. You know what he said to me? He said, am I a dog that men should send out someone like you against me with sticks? And you know what he called me after that? He called me buzzard meat. And I said to him, we'll see who's buzzard meat before the end of this day. You know, I knew that the battle was the Lord's. I turned down Saul's offer of his armor. And I nailed him, Solomon, with a single stone. Now, Solomon's reading this. He's saying, you know, I've only heard this story 100 times, Pop. I mean, lighten up. But he said, here's what I learned, Solomon, about that victory. First of all, I learned that God chooses his heroes from among the ranks of the quietly obedient. Do you know something, Solomon? I fought Goliath before I had learned better than just to trust God, just to rely on him for everything. I fought against Goliath before I became sophisticated. As I was looking over these notes this morning, I went into the library and I got out Samuel Johnson's dictionary published in 1787, and I read the definition of sophisticated. It's got a different connotation today. Let me tell you what sophisticated really means. It means to corrupt, to add something that's not meant to be there, something that is counterfeit, something that is not genuine. As our lives become progressively more sophisticated, I wonder if we, like David, see our power flowing away. David told Solomon that before I became sophisticated, I was powerful because I relied only on God. God chooses his heroes from amongst the quietly obedient. I stood in those ranks in those days, Solomon. Second, I learned that God's victories are not won on the battleground, but on the training ground. Solomon, do you know how God trained me? What kind of glamorous tools he used to provide me for that great encounter? After I had been anointed by Samuel to be the king, I thought I was going directly to the palace. But instead, he sent me back for years and years just to sit on the side of the hills and watch sheep. You talk about exciting, Solomon. You've never been involved in a sighting preparation program until you've watched sheep just chew grass and drink water. That's all that was going on out there for years. God trained me in solitude, obscurity, and in monotony. We're all so eager to get into the glory of the game, but we're not nearly so eager for the arduous years that go into the training. God's victories are won not on the battleground, but the training ground. Solomon is king. You're going to wonder how to ensure victory in every battle, and I'll tell you how to do that. Choose your battles very carefully. If you fight your own battles, you're going to lose. But the way to ensure victory in every battle is this: fight only God's battles on God's ground, in God's time, with God's weapons, and in God's strength. God taught me that through my encounter with Goliath. You know, as I sit here, Solomon, and look into the fire, the next name that comes to my mind and to my heart is the name Jonathan. Jonathan, Saul's son and my friend. You know, Jonathan could have been the king, and he would have been the king, but for the fact that God anointed me. Jonathan knew that, and he voluntarily stepped aside. And he not only stepped aside in my favor, he became my greatest friend. After Saul went mad with insane jealousy and rage and spent the waning years of his life trying to kill me, Jonathan's principal role was to try to reconcile the two of us. He was never able to do that, but that's what he tried to do. You know what God did? He sent Saul as an enemy to break my proud will. He sent Jonathan as a friend to sustain my poor spirit. Jonathan. I learned from him that God never allows a hurt without providing a healing. God never allows a hurt without providing a healing. Certainly I was hurt deeply by Saul, but a great part of the healing came through the friendship of Jonathan. And second, I also learned that whatever the source of the hurt, for healing, God uses people. Whatever the source of the hurt, for healing, God uses people. Solomon, you could probably ask me, how was it that Jonathan reconciled his friendship for me and his knowing that I was the anointed of the Lord with his loyalty to his father? How could he have possibly done that? I'll tell you how he did it. He did it by finally choosing to join Saul in his final campaign against the Philistines and to die by the side of his poor, mad, broken father, Jonathan, my friend. Well, the next face that comes to my mind, son, is the face of Abigail. What a woman. I met her shortly after I spared Saul's life in the cave at En Gedi, and I was on a high. You may know that in those days I was a fugitive, and I had a 600-man band, and we roamed the wilderness of Judea, and the way we made our living was by protecting the flocks throughout the winter of the rich landowners. And then in the springtime, we would come and collect our due, which normally meant that they would give us wine and they would give us bread and they would give us a few sheep for ourselves in payment for our having protected their flocks against wolves and bears and bandits. And the time came when we were to collect our payment from a man named Nabal. Nabal was a reptile, son. He was one of those guys who never did what he was supposed to do. And when I sent my men to collect, he said, "David who? I've never heard of him. Get off my land." I was infuriated. I saddled up my 600 men and I said, "I'll show him, David, who I'm going to nail his hide to my barn door." And off we went. But fortunately, we were intercepted by his wife, Abigail. She came to us with food. She came to us with bread and wine. And she said, "My Lord, don't let your hands be sullied with the blood of this worthless man, Nabal." As you know, Solomon, Nabal means fool in our language, and he certainly was. And she showed me that it would be a terrible way for me to begin my monarchy, which was shortly to commence, with blood on my hands. And so she convinced me not to kill him. And in the process of convincing me not to kill him, she taught me some valuable lessons. The first, of course, was that Great personal victories make us vulnerable and are often followed up by great defeats. I was coming off of a roll. I had just spared my enemy's life. Saul was in my clutches at the cave of En-Gedi, and I could have killed him with a stroke of a knife, and I let him go. And I was feeling so good about myself. And then I fly off the handle, mad with rage. I was about to go and kill Nabal. Great personal victories make us vulnerable and often are followed by great defeats. I also learned that anger is like acid. It eats up the container. I was totally consumed with anger at this man. I learned that anger, once it's confessed, loses its power, because I had to confess to Abigail that I was powerless in the grip of this anger. But once I'd confessed it, it lost its power over me. Do you know that when she talked to me, Solomon, she must have called herself my handmaiden 10 or 15 times. She was always referring to me as her Lord. She was a truly humble woman. But I learned something important from God about that. God's gift to the truly humble is great dignity. I've never known a woman with greater dignity than Abigail. Solomon, incidentally, a word to you as a future husband. Never make up your mind on an important subject until you check with your wife to find out if that's what you really think. She showed me. Wives can help men change their minds. The next person I remember is a name that may not even be familiar with you, Solomon, to you. His name was Uzzah. Uzzah was an extraordinary man who's only recognized in our chronicles because of a single mistake he made. He touched the ark and he dropped dead in the process. I was young. I had just been made king. I was anxious to move the ark into Jerusalem, and I didn't follow the rules. I had a group of men moving it. The ark began to tumble. Uzzah was standing by. He touched the ark. He was struck dead. I was terribly puzzled as well as deeply saddened by this. How could that have possibly happened? I had to go back to the books, into the books of Moses. I learned that I had committed a great sin. The ark, of course, carries the symbols of man's sin. Those symbols are meant to be borne exclusively on the shoulders of the Levites, who are symbols for us in turn of God, being God's representatives and intermediaries. And what they remind us is that only God himself can bear the terrible burden of man's sin. And there are no shortcuts to God except through his great representative. Now, as you know, Solomon, my line has been promised by God finally to produce that man, Messiah. So I learned from Uzzah that if I act in my own strength, even my best efforts on God's behalf are going to go terribly wrong. The next character that steps off of the stage of my life, Solomon, is a man with a very curious name, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was Jonathan's son. Mephibosheth was a pitiful character. He had been crippled in a fall when he was just a youngster. He had been in hiding in a terribly lonely and desolate place. I sent for him out of my fond recollections of my friendship with Jonathan, and I created for him a place of honor at my own table. From having fallen, from having been crippled, sent for by the king, set at his own table, and adopted into the royal family. We're all like Mephibosheth, aren't we, Solomon? We're crippled from our sin. We're in hiding from God. It is God himself who must reach out to us and call us and adopt us into his family and put us at a place of honor at his own table. And do you remember, Solomon, what Mephibosheth's name means? One whose shame has been taken away. I stand before you tonight, Solomon, as a king, a man whose shame has been taken away by the grace of God. Well, you knew I'd eventually come to this next one, Solomon. Bathsheba, your mama. Son, did I ever tell you about the first time I saw her? Well, never mind. We probably ought not to talk about that. Quite a woman in her day. Let me tell you some things that I learned from your mother, Bathsheba. When temptation comes, run. The only defense is to take to your heels. You can't help the first look, but the second one is on you. I got to step out of this and tell you that I was coming down the elevator in our building this week, and a young woman who attends this class said that she had just been listening to the David tapes, and that the week before, when she'd ridden down the elevator with me, she had just come to the part where I had said, you can help the first look, but you can't help the second. She said, you know, Mr. Mott, said, I was there in my exercise clothes, and I was just getting ready to go jogging, and you took a look at me, and you looked right up at the ceiling, and I said, yeah. That he really believes this stuff, you know? Sometimes it's not easy, though. Well, when temptation comes, run. Elevator, close quarters. There's no way to run until the door's open. But the second thing I learned from your mother, son, is this. The alternative to confession is cover-up. I wouldn't confess my sin with your mother. I wouldn't confess the sin of having caused her husband, Uriah the Hittite, to be murdered. And so what I had to do was cover up. There was no alternative to that. I also learned that unconfessed sins always travel in pairs. You duck one and the other one gets you. The sin of adultery was bad enough, but the sin of murder came like a haymaker. Unconfessed sin always travels in pairs. And then finally, that there are no great leaps into hell. We go down one step at a time, a long ladder that always leads downward. Well, you'd know that I would have to tell you now just briefly about Nathan, the great prophet. He's, of course, the one who nailed me. If you were to ask me, after 40 years of being a warrior king, the most courageous man I ever knew, I'd have to tell you it wasn't Joab, as courageous as he was as my army commander. The most courageous man I ever knew was Nathan the prophet, because he came directly to me and confronted the king with his sin. You know who was standing in that hall when he confronted me that day? Oh, my 300 bodyguards. I could have cut him down with a word, but he had no fear. Why is that? Well, because I've learned that if you're on divine business, you stand in God's power and under his protection. If you're on divine business, you stand in God's power and under his protection. And of course, I also learned that you can run from God, but there's no place that you can hide. As you might expect, I learned a terrible, bitter lesson from your half-brother Absalom. Absalom, Absalom, my son, would God I had died instead of thee. You know, I felt that way then, and I'll confess to you, Solomon, to a certain degree, I still feel that way now. You know what my problem was with Absalom, Solomon? I never disciplined him. Even as a boy, I never gave him any discipline or guidance or direction. And then finally, as he grew into manhood, it was inevitable what would happen to him. When Amnon committed that terrible sin with his half-sister, Tamar, raped her. And then when that crime was avenged, not by me as king, but by Absalom himself, and he became a murderer and fled. Do you know what I realized had happened to me? One of the terrible consequences of sin is that you forfeit your moral authority. You see, I couldn't correct Amnon for sexual sin because I was guilty of that myself. I couldn't discipline my son Absalom for the guilt and the sin of murder because I was guilty of that myself. One of the terrible consequences of sin is that you forfeit your moral authority. And also, of course, we never sin in a vacuum. We always hurt others when we do. Well, there are lots of other people in my life, Solomon, but it's growing late. I'll just touch on one more, and this one may surprise you because the last one I'm going to tell you about is what I've learned from you. From you, Solomon, two great lessons from the hand of God. First of all, you know your full name is Solomon J. Davidson. The J stands for Jedediah. Jedediah is the name in addition to Solomon that God gave you as you were being weaned. Jedediah means beloved of God. How could it be, Solomon, that your mother and I, having been guilty of such terrible sin, the king himself having fallen so far, could be blessed with a son whom God would call beloved of God? And you, the rest of your name, of course, is from Shalom for Peace. And you're the man who's going to build the temple. How could that be? Only grace. Only grace, Solomon. I'm reminded that in the midst of judgment, God remembers mercy. He has dealt so tenderly with me. And then finally from you, I've learned another lesson. And that is a lesson about broken dreams. I wanted to build the Temple of Solomon more than anything I've ever wanted to do in my life. More than I can possibly tell you, I wanted to be the man who built the temple, and God said no. He said, you're a man of war, and only a man of peace can build the house of God. And so God told me no. For me, that was a broken dream. But do you know what God did? He commended me for wanting to. And I've learned something about broken dreams from that. God accepts good intentions for good deeds if the heart is right. He credits us with having dreamed the dream. You know, when I get to glory, Solomon, I'm going to look at that temple that you're going to build, and my name is going to be on the cornerstone. If the heart is wrong, good intentions pave the way to hell. But if the heart is right, they are stepping stones to heaven. Well, son, just one paragraph more, and I'm done. That paragraph we find, of course, in our Bibles, in the 28th chapter of 1 Chronicles, the 9th verse. And you, Solomon, my son, know the God of your father, and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every plan and thought. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. David's last words to his son, he says, Solomon, if you know him, you will serve him. And if you seek him, you will find him. If you know him, take time, Solomon, to get to know God. You're going to be busy as a king. There will be some days when you feel there's no time for God in your life. But take time to get to know God. Because if you take time to get to know him, then you will serve him. And how will you serve him? You'll serve him with your heart. Not because you have to, but because you want to. With a willing heart and a willing mind. And then second, if you seek God, you're going to find him. Because there are really only two alternatives in your life, Solomon. You can either seek God or you can forsake God. And you can't be neutral. And then, of course, if you seek him and find him, you will find yourself. Well, son, it's late. The fire has burned down and the oil in the lamp is almost gone. Time to put these old rickety bones to bed and say, after I'm gone, if anybody should ask you what kind of epitaph I would like to have on my tombstone, if you can find a tombstone big enough, you might cause them to write something like this. A shepherd boy upon a hill, God called me in his sovereign will, from keeping sheep to leading men. God raised me up, then up again. Goliath fell, Philistines fled, the sound of praises turned my head. I fled from Saul, bird on the wing, 10 years and more, a hunted thing. But all those years I knew I'd be the king one day. God promised me that I would rule at last alone and wear the crown on Israel's throne. And that day came, the time appointed, triumph for the Lord's anointed. But then, alas, my wandering eye fell on Bathsheba. My, oh my. I lost my wits, my mind, my cool became lust's plaything. What a fool. From highest highs to lowest lows, I deserved and got hard blows. I wrote the Psalms and played them all, and great mistakes, I made them all. But I was never lost, you see. The God of love held on to me. When I was parched, he'd fill my cup. When I fell down, he'd lift me up and put me on my feet and say, keep going, David, on your way. And so, here at the end, I sing this last song to my God and King. And as the darkness falls, he'll wait to meet me at the eastern gate. I'll say, I'm here, no more to roam. And he'll say, David, welcome home. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the life of this mighty man. We thank you because we can relate to who he was. and what he did. We claim the promise, Father, that it's not perfection but devotion that warms your heart. Help us in Jesus' precious name to be devoted people. Amen.